You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer specializing in food and science. This podcast is called Feeding Britain, which just happens to be the title of a book by Tim Lang, Professor of Food Policy at the Centre for Food Policy, City University of London. Now, Tim has written extraordinarily perceptive articles and books about Britain's dysfunctional food system for years, and he shines a light into the darker sides of food politics, especially government sang-froid and short-sighted policy. Good example is that when he wrote to DEFRA recently proposing an expert committee on food and nutrition to work with SAGE, DEFRA said that nutrition was Public Health England's responsibility. Then Public Health England replied, well, the matter's actually for ministers to decide. Bizarre stuff. Now, Feeding Britain was published in March 2020, just 3 days after coronavirus lockdown began. I want to find out whether 4 months into a massive test of the British food system, Tim feels that anything's changed, and whether he thinks that the UK government will finally pull its finger out and tackle some of the big issues facing us all. Professor Tim Lang, thank you so much for joining us. For anyone who hasn't read your work, can you just start off by maybe attempting the impossible and give us a quick explanation of why you think Britain's food system is dysfunctional and how it arrived in this state?
Well, I don't just think it's dysfunctional. It's got some good things as well. So I'd like to make that to start with. I presume you're referring to my Feeding Britain book, which came out from Pelican just as Britain went into the lockdown. That was a book I set out, initially was asked to do about 8 years ago, but for all sorts of reasons only got down to properly 2 years ago. Obviously not expecting COVID-19 crisis to hit, but essentially it's a review of British food security, those two golden words. And the first thing I do is unpick, what do we mean by food security? Is it just bums on seats, enough tonnage of food coming in, or is it health consequences, capacity to cope with crisis and things like that? Is it food defence? Can you, as happened in World War One and World War Two, can you protect your food supplies? And I look at the complexity of what food needs to be in the 21st century and say, Britain ain't quite passing muster. We're doing some things quite well. The British have got more interested in food. It used to be famous for being sludge and brown sludge. And it's Europeanized. It's got more sophisticated. The range of foods that people eat. British children think pizza is their number one food and they think it's British. Actually, it isn't. So lots of interesting things have happened, but on stark measurements, does Britain feed itself? No, about 50%, depends how you measure it. If you include feedstuffs coming in, not even that. If you just say, well, only what we could grow here, well, not even that actually, only about 60, 70%. And if you look at inequalities, if you look at health outcomes, not good. So the first half of the book is about that, and the second half is saying, well, what do we need to do, and how can we unlock the lock-ins? What's stopping us dealing with this? And then I have a fifth of the book, a very big bit of it, of saying, you know, as a one-man royal commission sort of thing, daring to say what I think should happen.
Excellent. That's what we need, the solutions.
It is. I make 33 recommendations from that we actually need new legislation to ensure that our food is sustainable and healthy. And there's nothing at the moment other than the Climate Change Act that gives an imperative to that, through to what sort of guidance do we need, new system of guidance, do we need more citizens' engagement, through to how can we improve food defence? I actually think one of the critical issues from my book has not quite yet been picked up. It's being picked up in intelligence and some defence circles, but not in the mass public. Put it this way, if geopolitics of China versus Russia versus the United States versus Europe got nasty, Britain's in really serious problems and can't protect itself.
Yeah, but you've been writing about these issues for years. I've been reading your incredibly perceptive articles for years now. You must be boiling with frustration that nothing is really changing, or is that too simplistic? Do you think things are changing, but it's just not happening fast enough?
You can't see me, I'm nodding. I think it is too simplistic, if I may say so. Mm. I think a lot has changed. I think there's an enormous interest, and there's now even policy interest in food. In the banking crisis 2007-08, suddenly Britain, which, and the rich world, America too, the rich European countries too, suddenly woke up and said, oh my goodness, food on world markets has just doubled in price because oil has doubled in price because the financial system's gone into meltdown. We've got to sort this out. And then there was actually a very interesting 3 years under a Labour government, where they started taking it seriously. And they'd been mainly free trading, saying, well, leave this to the market. Something is now happening again under a Conservative government. They hate the European Union, so said, okay, get out of the European Union, it's all going to be perfect after that, and we'll just subsidize our farmers to look after the environment. And people like me said, food? Isn't farming about food? Isn't British land maybe something about food? And Michael Gove, because it was him, Secretary of State, said, oh my goodness, and immediately appointed fast food entrepreneur Henry Dimbleby to come in and try and do something. And Dimbleby's a good man and very thoughtful, but he was parked, then brought back in, then parked, and is now back in. But I think we're going to get a national food strategy, but it's being hemmed in by the new so-called global Britain, but also very insular Britain. So we don't quite know what's going to happen, but of course I'm hopeful. So there is engagement. To answer your question, but it comes and goes. And one of the things in my Feeding Britain book I do is give my readers a potted history of how we got into this. Well, the answer, it goes back a couple of hundred years and more. Britain is an imperialist country where we could just say, as we did in 1846 with the repeal of the Corn Laws, well, we won't bother to feed ourselves. We'll just get our empire to feed us. Mm. But today there isn't an empire, actually. And so the government and food companies say, well, we'll trade it. Really? How much? Let's get clear about this, is what I say. Well, is it good to be only 50% self-sufficient? Does it matter? I think it does, actually. I think you're risky. I think you can't defend it. I think it's using other people's land. And when you look at where Britain gets its food, it's using land, labour and water. And we don't want to use ours. Well, why? We've actually got very fertile land. We've got lots of people. We're rich. We're very divided, but we're rich. Why aren't we taking our own food system more seriously? So there is a real history to this about an assumption that let others feed us.
But this brings us on to my main question here, really, is so you published the book 3 days after coronavirus lockdown began on the 23rd of March. Has the lockdown? I mean, I think that the food industry would probably say that it didn't collapse and it coped surprisingly well with the pressures and the strains. Now, you level your guns a little bit at the just-in-time supply chain and the weaknesses of the supply chain, but they say that they would say it didn't collapse. Is that the case, or are the disasters that you've pointed out to us in the book hidden to our eyes?
I don't point out disasters because you can say from a British point of view, it isn't a complete disaster. Well, it depends how you define what you want. If you want people to be healthy, it is a disaster. We're obese. We've got a catastrophic burden on the National Health Service from diet-related disease. There is a massive inequalities between the richest and the poorest in Britain, and diet's a major factor in that. And the ecosystems damage caused by the food system. I confess, when I really got back into it, and this was the first time for about 45 years, I've only looked at my own country. Mm. I was genuinely shocked, if I can say, really shocked at the massive destruction of biodiversity associated with agrochemical use and things like that. So, but I don't think it's all a disaster. There's more interest. There's beginning some engagement. It isn't just as it was in the 1930s or indeed in the 1880s or the 1910s of just massive food poverty. We've got some food poverty, but we've got some food excellence. We've got some agricultural deserts, and we've got some islands of really good ecological practice. How can we rebalance that and recalibrate it is what I'm really saying. Dear Britain, I think it's time we woke up. And dear Britain, there are some processes we can get involved in, like the Dimbleby National Food Strategy, like the anti-obesity strategy. There's no good, just as the Prime Minister said in a former occasion, to blame fat people for it's their own fat fault, he said. Well, he was 17 and a half stone when he went into COVID-19 and he didn't do particularly well. Mm. But to get back to COVID-19, I think it's only worked well because 9 companies were basically given carte blanche. The government closed down food service. 2 million jobs went into abeyance. They could have been feeding hubs. They could have been community hubs. The Prime Minister's hero, Winston Churchill, that's what they did. They made community hubs. And you've seen in some areas around the country, in cities and towns and rural areas, where a bit of community hub feeding has emerged, despite support rather than because of it. Has it worked well in COVID-19? It's worked well because the European Union still feeds us. If we'd left the European Union really properly, we've been benefiting from the European food flows, 40% of our food comes from there and via there. Frankly, if we want to go it alone and become the 51st state, which part of the American, part of the government wants, well, God help us. So I think my answer to your question is, now I can summarize it and answer it quickly, we haven't been tested yet, actually. Mm-hmm. There was a disruption, yeah, badly managed, destroying food service, to say now it's all worked really well. Well, that's not what it's looked like if you're poor. There's 7.5 million people inadequately fed and going without in COVID-19. I don't call that a success, actually. It's not a good society that does that.
Mm. And are there comparable countries that have got it right that we can learn lessons from?
Yes, I think there are. No one's perfect. The rich world has basically over-consuming, over-parasitic. We're particularly bad for historic reasons, but I think we're beginning to wake up. I'm an academic and I can assure you the reason I say these stark things, and my book was originally for Penguin was going to be a small book and it turned into a very big book because, and I discussed it with my editor, who was very supportive. Look, we've just got to show the enormity of this. I don't want just to say something like now in a podcast. People might think, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about. There are 1,000 references in that book where I tried to say, look, this isn't me saying this is this expert group. This is that scientific body. This is this research about what's going on. I mean, it's putting it together that is the problem. But to answer your question, has anyone else been doing it well? Ironically, as we left the European Union, I've just been this morning on an extremely interesting 90-minute discussion with across the European Union of where people are beginning to engage with the need for a new European agenda about greening it and having a more from farm to fork approach and more about relocalizing, not just globalizing or regionalizing or internationalizing food systems. So there is good practice. My answer to your question is there's no one country that's got it right, but there is good practice emerging that all of us can learn from. And the collective learning is actually going on very fast at the moment. Next year, the UN is hosting a global food systems summit. I mean, there's big thinking going on now, belatedly, beginning to do what people like me were beginning to say 20 years ago, we've got to sort out the food system. The rich world is over and mal and consuming, and indeed also got major pockets of underconsumption and malconsumption, while half of the world or a third of the world, the poor world, is under-consuming, and everywhere biodiversity is being destroyed and we're producing excess carbon through food. So as a planet, we haven't got it right. Can we get it right? Yes, I was the policy lead on the huge three-year Eat Lancet Commission. The medical journal, The Lancet, takes 15, 20 people and throws them in a room for a year and a half, 2 years, and says, sort out, come up with solutions to this problem. Well, we were asked, can you feed the world healthily without destroying ecosystems by 2050? And feed everyone? Well, the answer, yes, you can, but it means a drastically different diet to what the British now have become used to, of being able to go to the shops whenever you like and eat whatever you like. That's not the way that we can feed the world adequately and healthily without destroying ecosystems. But can you have a good diet? Yeah, you can. Could we use our land in Britain better? Yeah, we could. There are major problems there. I cannot avoid them. The labour issue is critical. We've relied upon cheap, bought-in European labour. Well, if it's not going to be European labour, where's it going to be from? Bangladesh? India? That's what the Indians said. Okay, you want to deal with us? Well, you'll have to take our people. That's going to be really interesting for the people who voted Blue Tory in the north of England and the anti-migration field. There's some really delicate issues, actually. They're going to be thrashed out. Some people say, well, the answer to that is robotics. So that means more industrialization of food. The public says it doesn't want that, actually. It wants nicer, kinder, better for the environment, not more systematic, automatic robotic systems. So these are philosophical questions, actually, as well as very practical questions. So nowhere's got it right. To come back to your question, I haven't forgotten it. Nowhere, you can't say, oh, well, Sweden's got it spot on. Sweden is actually quite interesting. Norway too. But in dietary terms, the mythical Mediterranean diet we know is good. They didn't eat much. They ate very little meat. They ate it as feast day foods, not everyday food. They ate a lot of fish. Well, we're surrounded by water. Most of the fish that we pay, we sell. It's exported. There's a lot of change that needs to happen.
Yeah. And to bring this back to our current situation where we're still in lockdown, and to hopefully end this on an optimistic note, do you think that the pressures of lockdown are actually an opportunity to tackle systemic problems and to fix problems with the supply chain and our food system? And is there time still to take that opportunity?
Well, the last bit first, the time is narrowing. Let's be very clear. Food is one of, let me be very stark and sober. The role of food in driving climate change, water, stress. I mean, Britain, actually, people frequently don't believe me when I say this. Actually, parts of England are water stressed. And that's getting worse. And we've built houses on floodplains. We've built houses on prime grade one agricultural land that ought to be horticultural land. But can Britain sort this out? Yes, it could, but only if it takes food seriously. And if I can be pompous for a moment, through what in my world we call a multi-criteria lens. In other words, you don't just say cheapness is good, or healthiness is good, or the environment is good, or jobs is good. You try and do all of it. And that's a juggle. And that requires us to think very carefully and to be clear about it. And no one wants top-down Stalinist type old Soviet Union control. But what we've got is lack of control, actually, or bitty control. I argue in my book, we need what we call in my world sustainable dietary guidelines. And that's what the Lancet Commission was beginning to get to. But that needs to be done for Britain. It needs to be done for Wales as opposed to Southeast England, for North Scotland as opposed to Southwest Cornwall. There are different appropriatenesses in different areas, even within a relatively small mixed country like Britain. So I'm hopeful. I think COVID-19 has reminded people, You know, that when the government, I think, cack-handedly closed down food service, and the reason you could say, well, that's unfair of him, how dare he say that? The reason I say that is I'm a member of the London Food Board answering to the Mayor of London. I was under Mr. Johnson and I am under Sadiq Khan. Okay, so I'm not making a party political point at all. Mm. It was cack-handed because under the Civil Contingencies Act 2004, that I bet our listeners don't know, but I do know it, it set up things called resilience forums. Every area is supposed to have one. When we went to the London Resilience Forum, excellent people, no food thinking. So we began to do some food thinking around no deal Brexit, actually. And what emerged very quickly was we didn't have information. We didn't know what was going on. Indeed, people in the food industries didn't really know exactly the enormity of where they were. So there's a failure of planning, is my point. And these resilience forums are supposed to be there to deal with crises. And yet they didn't say anything about food. The National Infrastructure Commission, which you probably not heard of, is about the infrastructure for making Britain resilient for 50 years' time. 50, 50 years' time. It doesn't talk about food. It talks about flooding, about how roads and railways will get flooded, embankments will go. That's about food distribution. Well, what's the answer to that? Higher motorways, more motorways, or a decentralized food system where there's more regional capacity? I come back to the point of an earlier I made in an earlier answer. The British food system has not actually yet been tested. Mm. So I think COVID-19, your question, is a wake-up call. I think it began to get interest, partly because people were shocked when food service was closed down, I think cack-handedly, I have to say, and incompetently, but actually rightly at one level. People rushed to the supermarkets. A just-in-time food system couldn't cope with that. And then consumers were blamed. The government then blamed consumers for that. Well, I thought that was, I was originally a psychologist 40, 50 years ago. I just thought that showed the illiteracy of the government on food thinking about its mass psychology understanding. Mm. It was entirely understandable, entirely rational behavior. If you can't go and eat out in a country where 30% of food is taken eating out of the home, on the way, eating too much actually, if that goes, well, where do you go? You go to the supermarket. So actually what happened then, the government just said, okay, to the 9 retailers, you sort this, you deal with it. Mm. I've just received a letter from the Secretary of State, to a letter fellow academics and I wrote to him 2 months ago. And initially was a completely idiotic reply, so we'll forgive them for that. A serious 2-page Dear Tim letter came to me and my colleagues and said, look, we've managed it okay. But actually they haven't, but at least it was beginning to take it seriously. Mm. So I think there is a wake-up call. I think there are lessons to be learned, but whether it's systematic enough and fast enough, well, time will tell. But that ultimately, I think, will be up to us, the people, our listeners, to begin to engage with that and said, how much do we need? Where does this come from? Why is it like this? Why is Britain eating this ultra-processed diet full of fatty, salty, sugary foods that then puts us into the NHS and hits the poor worst because these are cheap foods as opposed to healthy foods necessarily. So these are complicated issues that you can't resolve just like that with a click of a finger. But we can begin, and we now know enough. When you can read the writing on the wall, you've got no excuse for not looking at the message.
Are you optimistic, Tim?
Yes, I am. My dead mother would always say it's because I came out backwards from her. Sorry to be personal. I'm a preach baby. So I came out backside first, not once, but twice. But then the obstetrician who dealt with my mother was my grandfather was a GP, was his partner who had the wonderful name Dr. Lily Crap. So I came out backwards. So I'm always optimistic. My reflex is to be optimistic despite the evidence. But I'm optimistic ultimately because I'm a people person. You know, it's only engaging with people. And when people get engaged, then actually the policymakers have to sort things out. And that's kind of beginning to emerge. I mean, I'm seeing people who 6 months ago wouldn't have dreamt of being angry really distressed and angry about the scale of food poverty in Britain. I'm seeing senior people in the food industries who really wouldn't have taken the sorts of arguments and the data I've been summarizing and summarized at length in my book. They wouldn't have taken that too seriously. Now they are. So I'm hopeful there. I think a process is beginning. We must make sure a controlling government doesn't bank it down and say, back to business as usual. That would be terrible.
Professor Tim Lang, Professor of Food Policy at the Centre of Food Policy, City University of London, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Tim Lang, Professor of Food Policy at the Centre for Food Policy, City University of London, and me, Stefan Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to gut microbiome analysis and careers in the industry. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.